The topic is maybe called Responses to Pain. Let me just tell you a little bit about how this one came to be. For quite a number of years, I was sitting in a small room about 10 hours out of 6 days of each week. And the room had one or two other chairs in it, and in those other chairs sat a constant succession of people who were in agony of one kind or another, usually not physical. It was during a period of time when I was functioning as a therapist. And after about 12 years of that, I decided one day that I should sit down and try to summarize some of the things that I'd learned from other people's agonies and the way in which they dealt with them, either successfully or unsuccessfully. And, well, you can't help learn something when people speak with the eloquence with which people do speak when they are hurting badly. But to me it was quite amazing that I could take most of what I had learned and put it together into a little formulation that said, here are the common denominators of the responses of hundreds, if not maybe 1,000 or more people, to the problems of pain in their own lives. Later, when I moved almost exclusively into hospital fields and sat closer to people with physical pains, I began to see that the processes that people use to draw on their resources in handling the problems of pain, successfully or unsuccessfully, were remarkably like they were when they were dealing with psychological agony or emotional agony or spiritual agony. So I decided just to put it out in this very simple form, and that's what I'm going to hand on today, and it's kind of a distillation. There'll be nothing startling and nothing new in it, I can guarantee you. But it may be helpful to review in your own mind your own ways of reacting to the pains of existence. Now, the word pain, that is, as I'm using it, is used in its very broad sense to take in all of those discomfortures of life that may be physical, as if, for instance, I'm pinching myself with my fingernails here, and right now it is hurting, and it is hurting plenty by what I'm doing right now. We'll come back, perhaps, to that a little bit later on. Now, that's one kind of pain, that physical sensation. Quite a different kind of a pain to, again, being somewhat biographical, to walk out of a place where you've been living for 20 years and to say goodbye to all kinds of good and very decent people who have been so much a part of your life, and then to know that you're experiencing grief. Not just the excitement of moving away and coming to the great and exciting place of Holden, but turning the coin over and knowing that the cost of getting there is great, because there is an agony that is built in. There's the kinds of agonies that come to people when they are losing loved ones, or losing jobs, or losing hoped-for goals. And some of the tragic pains of this world are not institutionalized. Let me give you an idea of what I mean here. Well, some of you know, my daughter died after a long and very dreadful bout with cancer a few years ago. And during that whole time, we had the support of everything in the healthcare system that could possibly help us in handling this terrible situation. And then we had scores of good friends who either by coming and touching us or by just sending us a little note or calling and just saying, how is she today, or just calling to say hello, made us aware that they were tuning in on our agony. And then when the time came when she died, then there was a funeral service. And there was a fine and meaningful and significant form by which the comfort was communicated. But let's say that it's a 16-year-old boy who just got dumped by some blonde who went for some other guy. The agony can be a very acute agony, and all he gets out of it is some kind of kidding. There's no funeral service for a grief that may be a very, very sharp one. Huh? I'm using almost a ridiculous extreme, except it isn't ridiculous for the guy or the gal that has built up hopes surrounding a relationship, a love relationship with another human being, and then all of a sudden found rejection in that. Dreadful agony, dreadful pain, of course. There can be pain of a thousand different types. There can just be the pain of those jarring, discordant things that happen in life that don't seem to make much sense. John brought a good perspective into the tailings the other night, but I suppose that most of us would say that there's something discordant a little bit in this place about the tailings. And the somewhat toxic stuff that keeps blowing off the blooming things. And even that can be something of an agony, something of a pain. All right, now whatever the pain is throughout in this wide spectrum of things, we all have ways in which we meet pains, and there are typical, rather personalized ways in which we handle the pains of our existence, the ways in which we react to them. And I can tell you a few things that are probably true about you because they are probably true about almost every human being. And that's what we're going to spend our time on this afternoon. Number one is that when you experience pain, outside of the hurt of it itself and all the physiology or psychology of that, there's one immediate response always to pain, and that's fear. You never escape that one. You may sophisticate it, you may even reduce it considerably, but you never get away from the automatic concomitant of fear to the pain situation. Now, I think we have to clarify some things right at the start and say that pain isn't bad, pain is good. The situation causing the pain may be bad, but the pain is a warning. It is part of God's good grace to us. Now, I've never been able to sing the doxology very loud over the fact I hurt until maybe afterwards I might be able to say, hey, that was all right that I felt the pain. Otherwise, I wouldn't have acted on the warning signal that pain provides. If I have a toothache, it's obviously telling me, among other things, I ought to get to the dentist to have it taken care of. Now, here's where fear comes in. Because fear tells me, and you better do it fast or it's going to get worse. Fear says, you may not be able to take it. Or fear says, if you let it go, it's going to cost you a lot more than now. That's a new kind of pain all of a sudden. What's happening is that the way God put us together, that anytime we feel pain, we also feel fear, which is a pain in itself. But pain is always multiplied by some fear factor. If we grow and mature considerably, we may modify to a considerable extent the way in which fear plays back into pain as a multiplying factor. Now, I think I learned clearest about the relationship, this multiplying factor of fear, actually not from one of my patients, but from my little boy one day. I had been teaching at the seminary, and I came home, and as usual, all dressed up, because that's the way you go to a seminary to teach, is dressed up. And you come home from it about the same way. And you wear rather subdued colors, and, you know, or used to at least. I look at this modern bunch of theological professors, and I don't even, you know, I'm jarred and jolted by the fact they might come in a red shirt or something. It's indecent. How can you be orthodox and wear a red shirt when you teach theology? Now, but anyway, I came home wearing a pretty good suit and walked in the front door of my house, and nobody was in the house. It didn't look like it was abandoned because the front door was kind of standing open, and I announced that I'm home, expecting that that would make the day for anybody that was inside the house. But got nothing but the echoes of my own voice. So I walked out in the backyard, and we had a beautiful backyard in that house. It, you know, it came out flat from the back door, and then it walk out basement kind of house, and then a big roll down to a nice, beautiful pond back there where the ducks used to come flying in. And, oh, it was fantastic. But I went back there because very often my wife and my son would be out there someplace. And my wife wasn't there, but my son was there, and he was about 3. So I said, "Hi, Davy," and Davy said, "Hi, Dad, come and roll with me." And I said, "Come and what?" "Come and roll with me." So he came up the hill to show me how he rolled. He, at the top of this very steep bank, he just stretched out and started to roll down the hill. And it did look like a lot of fun. I think somebody ought to figure out a way to, you know, to sell it, because it's got to be more fun than golf or anything like that. This rolling down a hill has got to be a, we ought to have a, there should be a good hill around here for rolling. You don't need to buy an outboard motor to attach to it or anything like that. Just roll. But when Dave said, "Come and roll," I said, "Oh, no, Dave, no. Dad's all dressed up." Well, he suggested that I might be able to change clothes, and I thought that's a pretty smart answer for a kid. I've got a bright boy here. But I wasn't going to go and change. I was tempted for a minute. But then I thought, what will the neighbors think if I, you know, theological professor, middle-aged, roll down the hill? That's got to be, you know, a little ridiculous. And because I thought it might be a little ridiculous, I lost out, I'm sure, on one of the great enjoyments of life, and that's rolling down a hill. Well, I'd even roll better today than I would in those days. See, I'm built for it today. But anyway, Davy was going to prove to me that this was an awful lot of fun, so he did it again, and he, watch me. And down the hill he went, and whirling like a dervish, he rolled a little bit off course, and his head went thunk up against a great big rock in a rock garden. And he hit hard. And I just gasped when I saw this. So I started to run down the hill after I had recovered from the shock of seeing him clunk his head and standing there wondering if he's going to stand up or if he was unconscious or whatever. Stunned for a few seconds, and finally he stands up. And he lets out a 3-year-old scream. Now that's, I don't know if they've devised an instrument yet that'll measure that in decibels, but that's got to be one of the loudest noises known to man, and certainly one of the shrillest. Well, there's something in Scripture about, like as a father pitieth his children, huh? And I felt some of that welling up within me, you know, the feeling sorry for my little boy who had now really clunked himself good. So I started to move down the hill with my arms open to receive this little guy and to comfort him. And he went right underneath, and then I heard what he was screaming, and he was screaming, "Mommy," which made me mad because there I was, you know, ready, available, had all the instincts at the moment for pity and for comfort and whatever. And he just went screaming up the hill, "Mommy, Mommy, Mommy." Mommy was down three doors having coffee with somebody. And she came running because she heard it. And I came running after David, who ran in the back door of the house, up the stairs. Mommy ran in top stairs. And she grabs this little guy, and he went right into her arms. And she sat down in a chair and started to rock back and forth. And now it gets ridiculous. At that point, when she's rocking back and forth, patting this guy who's got a bump coming out like a horn, and I suspected he was going to grow him someday anyway, because he was that kind of a kid. But she was rocking back and forth saying, "Oh, Mommy loves you, Mommy loves you." Well, of course she loved him. That, you know, I don't think he ever doubted that. I didn't doubt it. What in the world was she going through all that for? So I said to her, "Now, he hit himself very hard, and what he has to have," now I got real scientific about it, "what he needs is a cold compress. Can you get some ice on it right away?" Well, then I got the second jolt, because then she said, "Well, you're not doing anything. Why don't you do it?" So, you know, if I wanted to fuss around with that. And she keeps on rocking around with this stupid stuff. No, not stupid exactly, but not exactly pertinent to the situation kind of behavior of saying, "I love you." And I got mad, and I went out, and I grabbed the ice cubes out of that refrigerator, banged those things until finally ice cubes flying all over the sink. We didn't have an ice bag in our house. At that time, I thought that an ice bag was even inappropriate for a parsonage. So we didn't have one, but I got a big Turkish towel, and I'll tell you, if I'd ever gotten near that kid with that bag of ice that I had developed to treat that bump on his head, he would have been in a deep freeze forever. And I came running out holding this great big bag of ice, and holding the bag is exactly what I did, because by the time I got there and she had told him for the umpteenth time, "Mommy loves you," the little kid decided he could face life, squiggled down out of her lap, and said, "I will go and roll again." Now, he thought better of it once he started, but and got out there. But this horn coming out of his head was bigger than ever, brighter red, which says something about more pain coming in that thing. The pain thing, outside of that, maybe that first jolt, the pain had, if anything, increased, and now this thing was throbbing, huh? You've all had bumps like this. There hadn't been any particular decrease in the amount of physical reaction to the blow, to the bump itself. Now, he came up screaming up the hill and walked out saying he was going out to roll some more. What had happened? Well, what had happened is a very simple little thing. Mommy said, "I love you." Love casts out fear. Huh? And with no fear multiplying the pain, he decided he could handle the pain. And wow, if we could only learn that one. Because if there's anything that modern man has been discovering about pain, it is that if it is not multiplied by fear, you can take it. It may be excruciating pain, but a human being has magnificent capacities for standing almost all of the pains to which we are subjected. If we don't get panicky because of fear that multiplies the pain. Now, let's just say that when Davy came up the hill, he ran up the hill with, let's say, 10 units of pain, huh? If you could put a value on these. So he came up the hill with a pretty good bump, and let's say that he had 10 units of pain. Now, there ought to be some normal reaction to 10 units of pain, and let's say that normal reaction is given a factor enough to balance it out so that it is 10 units of fear is the appropriate response to 10 units of pain. The pain says there's something wrong. The fear says you better do something about it. Now, a little kid doesn't figure that one out, but maybe reading it into the little kid, the father ought to figure out you ought to do something about it. I figured an ice bag. Mommy figured to say, I love you. The ice bag would have helped a little bit. Well, it would have terrified him. That's what it would have done, I guess. But Mommy's love, saying, I love you, helped a great deal. Now, let's just say that he had 10 units of pain, and it was multiplied by 10 units of fear, and he gets 100 units now of pain, because it's multiplied into that. That's when he's going up the hill. Mother says, I love you. That erases this. And he's back to 10 units of pain, and the kid's a tough kid. You can live with that. I don't know how many times I've seen this work, when people in the midst of their pains have been eloquently told that they are loved, and then find what people usually say is the courage to face the pain. That's one way of saying it. It's probably not the most accurate way to say it. The pain is actually reduced, because the multiplication factor is eliminated or seriously reduced. And we are put together in such a way that we can handle most of the pains of our existence. That doesn't mean that we're without the pain then. It just means that it's reduced to manageable proportions, and that there are strengths within the human being to walk upright with almost all of the pains of his existence. A lot of the pain clinics that are most successful are making use of something just exactly like this to go along with discipline, training, and some drugs, but minimal. Now, I'm not suggesting that for all your pains you just find somebody who loves you and then don't bother about using aspirin or whatever. That's not what I'm talking about. But I am saying that if you can find somebody who loves you, and if you can accept the love that somebody can give to you, that you can probably handle the pains and almost any pain that's going to come out at you from this day on to the day you die. And there are lots of people who have already demonstrated this one. Not least those saints who keep on marching in, who have so many times handled their pains with tremendous courage, and partly because their pain is less, because they know that God loves them. And that there's an ultimate background, an ultimate base, a floor of love upon which they walk their lives. And even when human love may not be that eloquent, many a saint could testify to the fact that even in the midst of that kind of loneliness, or the loss of the last significant meaningful persons in their lives left alone, they have been able to walk in the awareness that God loves. Now, there are some kinds of fear that tip us off to a lot of other things in life and about ourselves. If, for instance, I have a pain in my belly, and it's right after I have eaten sauerkraut and wieners, sauerkraut and wieners, it's quite likely that all I'm doing is experiencing the fact that German food doesn't go very well with Norwegian chemistry, you know, or something like that, and isn't all that significant. But if I should have that pain, and then should all of a sudden kind of blow my stack and go screaming around that I've got cancer, without even waiting long enough to find out if it's a gas pain, but kind of jumped to the conclusion right away that it's cancer. Then I got problems, because now I am reading into the little pains of life a great deal of fear. Now let's just say, to use the same 10 here, but multiplied, you know, by 100 units of fear. Now you got panic coming out at the other end, haven't you? Not just a normal amount of fear for an appropriate amount for the situation. Now you got panic. But you have another problem here. You got to figure out, where in the world does all this fear come from? It can come from misinformation. Just think of all those childbirth situations in which daughters, it isn't quite so true today, but it was true just a few years back, in which daughters have learned by hearing their mothers and a whole lot of other people talk about the excruciating agonies of childbirth, and expect as they go into childbirth that it's going to be exactly that, and go in with panic. Now, there are a lot of things that have contributed to the diminution of pain in childbirth. Some of them maybe not even be all that good. But again, I think that there's been enough demonstration that there, that if you eliminate the fear factor from childbirth, there is simply less experience of pain. So misinformation is one of the things. You can be taught. I could be taught, I suppose, that any pain in my stomach is probably related to some incipient cancer. And if I believe that, then I don't know what I do with this 100 units out here of the fear factor. So misinformation can contribute to the enlarging of the fear factor. But it is more likely that the repression of other emotional experiences is what's doing this. And then I kind of welcome a pain out here that it can explain my agony. I welcome the pain. I learned this best, I think, from a Dr. Reinierson, who was for a long time head of internal medicine at Mayo's in Rochester. And he was speaking at some little seminar I was putting on for doctors and pastors one day. And we sat at breakfast before his first lecture. And he was telling me about his work as head of the Department of Internal Medicine. And among other things, he said that he believed that he probably told more people than did any other doctor that they either had cancer or didn't have cancer, because he had reserved for himself, as head of that department, the responsibility for telling people the results of their tests. Now, in those days, this was done primarily through the internist, the doctor of internal medicine. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, it's mostly done off by surgeons. But when I said to Dr. Reinierson, you know, that must be a terrible thing to have to do, to tell people that they either have cancer or don't have cancer, and spend a good chunk of every day breaking this kind of news to people, must be a terrible thing. He said, well, it is. Then I said, to tell that number of people that they have cancer, and he said, no, you missed the point. It is not those that have the cancer that I have my problem with. It's telling people they don't have cancer. But how can that be? I asked. Well, he said, you got to understand a little bit about Mayo's. Now, think back, this is 20 years ago or so. At that time, Mayo's was kind of the witcher than which there was none witcher or something. You know, all over the world, that was the great place. So some guy turns up with a pain, and he lives in Peoria. Is that a good place to choose? I think so. So he goes to the local doctor, and the local doctor runs some tests, and he comes to the conclusion, there's nothing I can find here at all. I don't think that you've got any problem. And the guy says, huh. And I thought he was a good doctor, and he couldn't find it. So he goes then to the doctor with greater reputation, or to the clinic that has more reputation. And he keeps on anting this thing up. He goes to the university hospital, because surely those guys are going to be smart enough to find out what this pain's all about. By this time, he's quite sure that it must be cancer, because only cancer is big enough to explain the amount of his agony, which may be somaticized into a physical pain, but is not to be described in terms of the physical pain alone. Has to be described in terms of a total body of agony. And only cancer is a big enough word to explain. So then Reinerson says, no, to him, hey, I got good news for you. You don't have cancer. And the guy's traveled halfway around the world maybe to get there to find, because here they can surely explain his agony. And in all probability, it's going to be cancer or else something brand new that's bigger than cancer or more dreadful. And then he says, hey, there's nothing wrong with you. We've put you through every test. The person says, and this is the best place in all the world. At this point, the rug is pulled out. They cannot explain the agony of their existence. And we've taken away from them any respectability in this situation. Now, obviously, if you got cancer, you got a perfect right to feel like you're hurting, huh? But what if you don't have cancer and you still hurt the same way, or you don't have anything that you can tack a respectable label on? Oh, you're nuts. It's all in your head, or whatever. No. You're neurotic. And we take away the respectability that a good, solid explanation like cancer can give, and leave them naked. And that's no fun. And send them back home again. And this is what Reinerson was concerned about. And this is why this guy, who had enough to do that those days without coming around talking to a bunch of us, this is why he put it on such high priority. He said, you got to help. You have to help. And find ways to cut into and to understand and help the person understand what in the world is bringing about 100 units of fear here. What is this tremendous agony? And very often it is compounded out of all kinds of experiences, maybe starting all the way back in childhood, but maybe just being as recent as a few weeks ago, in which we have put away the dreadful agonies of life as not being willing to face them. Guilts, hostilities, inordinate fears, pushed down, not dealt with through a simple process that I'm sure you all know is repression. Repression is just getting emotions waterlogged. If you take a log up in Heart Lake, huh? At the end, some of them are floating, right? And some of them have sunk to the bottom. The ones that have sunk to the bottom just been there too long. They get wet and they stay down there. If I have something uncomfortable to think about, something I don't like to face, something I don't like to admit, something I don't like to feel or realize, I can very readily kind of push it down out of my mind for a while. We have enormous capacities to take things in consciousness and push them not out of mind, that's a common phrase, but it's not true, but into mind. More deeply. And when you push them down into mind, they stay there for a little while, but the mind's an interesting thing. It says the unconscious mind, because that's what you put it now for a while, huh? Down below consciousness. The unconscious mind, which is a very good mind, says maybe now is the time he wants to face that. So it's raised up into consciousness, offered, do you want to think about this now or do you want to face it? And if I am the kind who says no and push it down again, then after a little while, some other next morning, whenever, up it comes. And if at that time I push it down again, after a while the unconscious mind says, he doesn't want to bother with this. And puts extra protection every time it starts to come up to be faced. The unconscious mind says he doesn't want to listen to it anyway. Keep it down. He's told us that. He's instructed us. Or he's instructed this mind. Well, let's put that in simple terms. You could divide the whole world, I think, into two classes, those who hear alarm clocks and those don't. The difference is about 6 mornings of turning it off. And if you're normally intelligent, you know, about all you have to do is hear the alarm clock 6 mornings in a row, reach right over and turn it off, go back to sleep, pay no attention to it, and you probably will not have to face an alarm clock noise the rest of your life. It's kind of attractive stuff. I turned out Beanie years ago, right here. You know, just tuned him right out so I never hear these chimes in the morning, beautiful as they are. But they're, to me, they're an alarm clock. Now, my unconscious mind hears those things. There's nothing wrong with my ears. If you tested my ears, they'd be probably as good as your ears. But, you don't hear with your ears. You hear with your mind, of course. You hear with the hearing center in your brain. And the unconscious mind has said, hey, don't pay attention to this alarm clock. Getting back to the bad noises, not the sweet ones that Beanie produces. So the unconscious mind, which is the only mind you've got when you're asleep, says, don't bother the guy. He doesn't want to be bothered. So then you don't have to hear it. Now, that's kind of like the way repression works, except the repression works with the unconscious mind doing this when you're conscious, as well as when you're unconscious. You may get all fussed around, and if you want to go into a whole bunch of psychoanalytic theory at this point, you can get all fussed around now with what happens in your dreams and dealing with this stuff. If you won't dream with it, won't go with it in consciousness in the daytime. But you can build up a body of fearsome stuff. Horrible, nightmarish, tangly kind of junk back there. You're more, actually, if you looked at it, it's not all that bad. But the feeling you get out of this pressure system of stuff that is repressed, bidding for some kind of attention, the pressure of it itself, then it tries to explain itself by any way it can. Just like we sometimes talk about free-floating anxiety, and we're talking about dread, we're talking about anxiety, in part. Free-floating anxiety, it just dribbles, you get anxious about this, and you get anxious about this, and actually flipping around like a bumblebee, trying to find some place, you know, where you can get some kind of an answer to why you feel anxious. Testing out a lot of things. Usually there are false ones that you test out because they're acceptable if you are dealing with repressed things. Already, by definition, the repressed stuff is kind of unfaceable, or you don't want to face it. So you try out to explain it with the conscious mind, part of the mind now. You try it out on things that are reasonable or satisfactory. I may have, for instance, hated my mother. But that's a dreadful thing, and it isn't decent at all, and you certainly can't, you know, shouldn't be hating your mother. But I might try out, now, getting terribly mad at the kid next door, or at the boss, or, you know, whoever, or a school teacher when I'm a kid, because I don't dare hate my mother, but it may be more respectable to hate. And kids growing up in Christian families get an awful load of some of this stuff, that it isn't decent. Remember the fourth commandment, huh? And if that is taught in terms of abnormality, as it often is, that there's something horribly abnormal about you, if you even hate your parents, then you can push this thing down and all kinds of crud buries it and crusts it over and keeps you from being forgiven, because it's been available for examination and for the application of forgiveness. Now, if you have small pains, and they always turn out to be enormous pains, panicky kinds of pains, and you might take a look to see if you are investing your pains with some of the pressures growing out of other situations. Now, you may need some professional help if this is a bad enough situation in finding a way, because it isn't easy to dig down through. I can't do it to myself. I might be able to help somebody else sometimes uncover some of the layers that are on top. You may need, you know, somebody with different kinds of skills and more skills than I have. Maybe that you have to go through the terribly expensive thing in some, I think, small number, fraction of cases. Use the deeper kind of psychoanalytic kind of things to get at some of those things, but usually that's not necessary. But you have to get at and depressurize if you're not going to get trapped into this sort of a thing, which then makes your pains feel all the worse. Now, let me jump to the next one. I don't think we're going to finish all this, but I want to give you at least a hint of where we go with the rest of the formula. Let's take it this way and say that pain is what we're starting out with. Yep. Rain. Explain that one. Pain. It always results in fear, to some extent, and it not only results in fear, but it also is a pain or comes into the whole dynamic and increases the pain. It is accomplished by way of some kind of multiplication. Now, at the same time that that happens, something else is going on, and that is that you always feel hostile. Always. There's no escaping that. If you feel pain, there is anger. If you want to see this in its rawest form, you probably see it in suicide. Now, suicide is by definition the result of dreadful agony and pain, huh? So bad that you just don't want to live here anymore. But it's been long known that you turn over any kind of serious depression and you've got hostility as its other side. When I was a kid, I used to have some suicide thoughts, and they ran something like this. Well, if I died, they'd be sorry. And I still do it. Every once in a while, I'll have some kinds of fantasies of that kind. Now, I'm not sure that that makes me all that different from you, but check it out. Some people have defined suicide as the ultimate expression of hostility. Obviously, it's ultimate, huh? It's about as ultimate as ultimate gets. Seward Hiltner used to define suicide as an extreme discrepancy phenomenon. And he said that, well, for instance, more people commit suicide in April, May, and June in our hemisphere than any other months of the year, simply because the weather is nicer and it comes as a surprise. If you've been living through a gooky Midwest winter, or a Seattle winter for all that, and you've been depressed, well, you can say, well, when spring comes, I'll feel better. Then spring comes, but you don't have the buoyancy to feel better to react to spring. You don't hear the birds because you're trapped with the hostility, I mean with the depression. And everybody is saying, hey, what a great day. And if I can't feel a great day, you haven't done me any service by telling me it's a great day. You've only increased my burden. The difference between the way I feel and the way I ought to feel is an additional pain, additional agony, additional burden. That's why some of us would never think of trying to cheer up a depressed person. No way would we touch it. And certainly not by going around saying, God wants you to have joy. It's obvious that God wants us to have joy, but you tell that to a depressed person who can't begin to respond with joy, and then God is deserted. I won't even pray with a depressed person. Now, that's my own hang-up. But for much the same reason, I'm afraid that he thinks, may think, now that the prayer is going to have a subjective reaction within him soon. He's going to feel good. And if he can't, then God is forsaken. So instead of that, I sit down and try to help them to express the bitterness of their pain and the anger, the hostility to which it is related. I have helped any number of people to do what I've had to do in my own life, to double up my fist and say, "Damn you, God," or some other such expression. And then to know, somehow or another, out of all that, that nothing happened anyway, you know, that was bad. And it got some of the real, honest, true hostility straight up where it belongs, in the face of God. Where it can be dealt with. It is quite an experience to walk around in the middle of a night and shake your fist up beyond the stars at the God that you think is ultimately responsible, and to be able to walk towards morning with the awareness that he didn't clobber you with all the power of heaven, but somehow or other just swallowed it up, accepted it. Well, I hope you never have the kind of agony that makes you want to do that, but if you do, do it. It's a great experience to have all that stuff roll in because you got the clutter of the hostility out of the way. To have all those things you've learned from childhood about God's goodness and his love and his acceptance and his forgiveness, to have that start popping in on you because the hostility was expressed and therefore got moved out. Now, we always react with that hostility. That's universal now. A little kid goes running around through the living rooms, let's say, and he bumps his head on the corner of the table. What does he do? Say, "Excuse me, table, I'm sorry that I bumped you." "That table bumped me," you know, right away, huh? Right away, he's angry at the table that hit him. Now, I'm an adult, and let's say that my son and I, 3 years old, let's say, and let's say it's Jeff up here, walking down with Werner, walking down the street. And let's say that Jeff and Werner both at the same time trip over a stone, and they land skinning their knees. It would be quite likely that Jeff would stamp his foot and say, "That stone tripped me," or whatever, you know, some equivalent of that. But you wouldn't see Werner standing there kicking at the ground saying, "That stone." But he might talk about the guys that are supposed to keep that street free of stones with some interesting language or expressions, huh? Which is the same thing exactly, except that you do it in a little bit less obviously childish a way. And so most of the hostility that we feel in relationship to pain is handled simply by some kind of camouflage to make it look like it's an adult reaction to a situation and not a childish stamping of the foot or striking back at the table that bit us or whatever. But it's kind of fun it isn't fun because these aren't fun things, but you can chuckle once in a while when you find yourself getting mad and you remember something like this and you say, "I got mad about that situation and didn't deserve it. How come I got so mad?" Well, it's because there was pain back in there someplace. Not necessarily the immediate thing. Not necessarily hitting at the table that bumped your head, or kicking at the stones that tripped you, or even at the crew that should have kept the roads free of the stones but didn't. It may even be displaced into another situation entirely. Jumped over to something absolutely unrelated. Well, I remember one day Al Rognes, some of you know him, huh? He was here a little while ago. He was my boss. He was the president of the seminary, and I was teaching there. And one day Al called me into his office, and he said, hey, Fritz, you know, how are things going? Fine. Nora and I were thinking that we haven't been together for a while. Why don't we, you know, sit down and have some coffee, or we'll come over to your place some night, and we miss getting together. It's been a couple months now since we've had an evening together. And he kept talking like this for a while, and then finally he said, just about the time we're deciding that the next class was coming up or something, and he said, oh, Fritz, he said, you know, I'm the worst offender in this, and I could see that Al was hurting, and there was something that was embarrassing him. Finally, he was trying to tell me that I was gone a little bit too much, and I'd missed too many of my classes I was supposed to teach, but he was calling himself the chief offender in this. But he said, you know, students don't quite like it when you're not around. And now I know that what you're doing is more important, or, you know, you've got to do this. If there's some way to arrange it, it'd be... And Al was going through agony. Some of you know how much this would have killed him. Well, what did I do? I could react in several ways. I could say, hey, listen, buddy, if there's anybody around here that's the offender on this, it's you. Because that would have been true, too. Now, that's one of the things. I could have taken his tie and shortened it up until his tongue hung out. Say, don't talk to me that way. I suppose I could have hit him, but it doesn't happen very often in theological seminaries that you hit another professor or even a student. Feel like it? Yes. A little bit like that story again that Al tells about the guy at his 50th anniversary, wedding anniversary, who was asked to, by somebody, master ceremonies, if during that 50 years he'd ever contemplated divorce. And the guy said, divorce? No. No, never divorce. Murder many times, but never divorce. Well, there's just some things you don't do in theological seminary. You don't get the boss or the president. You don't even contemplate. Now, there are some other things I could have done, though, and probably did. I could have taught those monkeys, those smart alecky seniors, a lesson, because they thought that I would never throw a surprise test at them, a quiz, and they're in for a rude surprise. Now, not because I said, hey, I'm going to get at L by giving my class a surprise quiz when they're not expecting it and slapping down good, but I got a little unresolved something floating around here, and I got to find some place to deliver it, and I could just as well dump it on a class. And if you don't think professors sucker in on that one, you got another guess coming. You got to understand those guys, because they do it. But, you know, you like to kind of keep those guys friendly too, because there's a competition among faculty members for popularity. Don't think they're all so objective and up above all of this stuff. No, instead of that, you go home. I remember the day that Al told me this one. I didn't unload a test on those guys in that class. But all the way home, I was uncomfortable, and I don't even remember thinking about what Al told me, but I did remember later that I was uncomfortable the whole way home. And I got home, and I sat down in the chair after saying hello to Gertrude, but not very cordially. And if I kissed her, no, I wouldn't have under those circumstances. She would have had to kiss me, or there wouldn't have been any kissing. But anyway, I sat like I always did that day, got into a chair, the tired professor, who'd had a weary day, not knowing quite well he was weary, and I opened up the paper, and I did a little hiding. Now, all of a sudden, David, age 3 or something, comes exploding through the middle of that paper and lands in the middle of my lap. That was a mistake. That kid, smart enough to be my kid, he should have known better than to jump through that paper on that day. Now, the fact that we've been doing this every night for 2 weeks, and I'd come into the house and know David, and I would say, "Where's David?" No response. "Where's David?" Well, where could he have gone? And I'd sit, and all of a sudden I'd hear the patter of little feet coming, and right through the middle of the paper, bang! And then I'd take the kid, throw the paper away. That's my boy, you know. Now, that's 13 nights out of 14. It was the 14th night, and he didn't know that Al Rodness had told me I ought to stick around and earn my living. And the poor kid, I don't know, he had to get a little older before I could tell him that it was because I had a pain, and the pain led to some hostility, and I couldn't hit Al in the nose, and I didn't want to get my students all mad at me, but I know my kid loves me. Let him have it. Or my wife. That's partly what wives are for. To love us. So that the hostility gets kind of eaten up. That's a thought too. It's probably what husbands are for. Huh? I'm not sure we all buy that, but... Yeah, that's what marriage is all about, isn't it, huh? To be able to be real, true, even if these are uncomfortable and negative things. To have a place where you belong enough not to have to be afraid. Where it's safe to paddle your kid because you know he loves you, he isn't going to... Even if you're paddling because you got mad at the... Another situation, huh? That isn't going to kill a kid. And besides that, are just general principles I think they ought to be every once in a while. It isn't by accident that God made the shape of a father's hand so almost exactly conforming to a part of a kid's anatomy. I don't think that's just by accident. You ought to whop them once in a while. Ah, you know what I'm saying, don't you? When we unload our hostilities, even though we call it discipline or something, nobody's going to get destroyed if it's in the context of love. Just don't spank your kid ever if you don't love him. I don't mean that you don't feel like for a moment. Every father that is honest has to admit that there have been times when he could gladly have thrown his kid out the window. My kids, man alive, I had two of them, both of them. Demonic awareness of Saturday nights. Good kids all week long. Saturday night, they had to kick up a fuss. And Saturday night's the night before Sunday for a preacher. And man alive, it's one night that you don't want to be bugged by a kid squawking or misbehaving. And my kids chose Saturday nights, invariably. You know why, don't you? It started around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, that I was short-tempered with them and then don't get out of my way, and don't bother me, and, you know. And the whole family gets juices running in reverse direction in their body and all kinds of stuff happening. My wife wasn't quite as soft in her arms with the kid because I was unreasonable, because I was uptight, because I didn't know how the sermon was going to be tomorrow morning. But moments where you can be real, if you haven't got a home, then you got problems. Selves and to be real. And not simply to be contributing to the negative dynamics up here in each moment of the day or each incident that comes up. Well, another time we'll get at the other half of this. It goes from there. Hostility always leads to fear. Obviously, because if you're mad at somebody, you're afraid they're going to get mad back, huh? If you hit somebody, you duck. Because you're afraid of retaliation. You can't deliver hostility. The third part of this one, coming down the line, is anytime you feel hostile, you feel guilty. Simply because at creation, God wrote his law in the hearts of men. Remember that, some of you, in the catechism, please? He gave the law in forms of the Ten Commandments to Moses, huh? But there's another way in which we received the law, and that was that he wrote it in the hearts of men. I don't know, you know, he didn't take a pencil, but he gave us some kind of intuitional awareness that it is right to love and it is wrong to hate. And that's all the law is all about, isn't it? Thou shalt love. First subdivision, thou shalt love God and your neighbor as yourself. Second line of subdivisions, you know, the first three commandments and all the seven commandments. Huh? But it all summarizes down to thou shalt love. And down in the awareness of every human being is that awareness that it is right to love and it is wrong to hate. Herman and I have both been in New Guinea. Before I went to New Guinea, I read Fraser's Golden Bough. Probably still is the big classical anthropological work. Fantastic library of information. One thing kind of struck me in Fraser's Golden Bough. I happened to be reading it not long before I first went to New Guinea on the advice of the United States government. I was in the Navy. But I've been reading something about the Papuans, and I found out I was going to New Guinea, and I doubled back to read what Fraser had to say in the Golden Bough about the Papuans. And in there he said that some of them are cannibals. But that there was an exception to what he had said, established as a principle, that no matter what, how primitive the culture became, there was always a systematized guilt feeling in connection with all hostility. That in every culture, this is built into the society in order to control its hostilities. They are taught to feel guilty whenever hostility is expressed. But Fraser says, for every rule, you know, there's an exception. And the exception to this rule, the Papuans in New Guinea, who can eat their brother and not feel guilty. Well, Herman knows as well as I do, it isn't quite the way it is. It's a religious ceremony, and it's kind of a conservation thing. I mean, they don't just throw away things. And particularly the energy of the one who just died, you know, like the biceps, strong arms, so they eat some muscle here and get some of that strength. This may even be your own father. It isn't a vicious act of, you know, gluttony or just hostility towards somebody. It is to take the strengths, the virtues, the courage from the heart, you know, for instance, the brains. So these things aren't lost by throwing them on the ground, letting them be corrupt. Interesting. The very last thing that they do is they pass around a bowl of water and everybody washes his hands while they pray a prayer, sometimes chanted, asking the departed one not to hold all this against them. Fraser, who had done such superb research, had missed on the Papuans, the one exception, he felt, who could do hostile things without feeling guilt, have the most eloquent Pontius Pilate act of all built right into their society. Well, obviously, if you feel guilty, you're going to be afraid. Because you deserve hell. Huh? That's what it's all about. If you're guilty, you deserve punishment. And the ultimate punishment would be hell. That's why people like to hang on to hell as a very live possibility in their lives, because they can't hang on to their guilts and live with them. And man has enough ego that he just ain't going to let anybody else pay it for him without a struggle. And the gospel is a stumbling block always. The last thing I want is to be helpless, defenseless, and insufficient. And to come to that point of ultimate surrender, where I have to say, you know, nothing in my hands I bring. That's a tough one for me. That's where we die, is at that point. And to be crucified with Christ is to experience that. We die in order that we might live. Where you start out with a pain and you end up with hell. And hell is a pain. Now we got all started all over again. Unless something radical cuts in. And that's the cross. It's kind of interesting, I've talked about forgetting pain now, but talked about fear and guilt and hostility, huh? And if there's anything that psychiatrists and psychologists get all bugged about, it's those three great negatives. They're so hard to handle in life. And some of them have tried to erase the guilt thing by saying, hey, that's just a lot of foolishness. We got taught and instructed in it. Somehow or another, they haven't been very successful since Freud first said it, in eradicating the need for guilt feelings. Remember something Paul said, huh? Now abideth faith and hope and love, these three. After, you know, considering everything else. Now abideth faith and hope and love, these three, and the greatest of these is love. And I think I see a very close, direct kind of a tie to these three great negatives of hostility and guilt and fear. The opposite of hostility is, I suppose, love, huh? We love or we hate, we put these in polar relationships to each other. The opposite of fear, what's that? Well, the Christian word hope here is probably the word that we're looking for on that one. Because fear is a way of looking at the future. I tremble at what is going to happen next or next week or next year or after I die or whatever. Fear is a posture towards what's coming towards you or towards that which you're moving. Hope is a posture. I'm persuaded that nothing, there, here, any place down there, nothing and nobody can separate me from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus my Lord.
Wouldn't that be faith?
All right, now you get faith, but now you get hope. I don't have to be afraid. There's nothing can separate me. It's a posture towards the future. Faith, of course. See, faith is a big word here now. That I may have faith that wraps itself all around all three of these things. But I don't have the faith except for the fact that love is the greatest of all of them, because I wouldn't have any faith if it wasn't for the love. Was, after all, God who so loved the world that he gave. And otherwise, I don't have anything to have faith in and nothing to have hope in. Hope opposite of fear. Love cancels out the fear. All these things get now intertwined, surely. Love that makes all of them possible. Guilt, the opposite of that isn't innocence. No way. The opposite of guilt is forgiveness. Because there is none good, no, not one. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Just forget this sinlessness or the triumphalism. We ain't going to make it. But forgiveness, it's available, it's here, it's in the moment. Now, it's in with this, within this faith that he daily and richly forgives me and all believers all our sins. Huh? It's walking in the, if I am in the faith, I don't even have to confess anything. I may need that as a personal discipline. But I have sinned a great deal this day, but I haven't been to confession this day. Sometime towards evening, I'll probably take a few minutes to tell God, here I went again. You know. But if I forget it, no strain. Because moment by moment, in this faith, living in this faith, which is then a relationship, I am forgiven. Faith, hope, and love, and maybe the ultimate healing then is wrapped up in some old ancient concepts and realities named by an apostle so very, very long ago. It's almost time to eat. Someday we'll take up this last part and won't touch it so hard and fast. Okay?